Hello, everyone. My name is Anirudh.
And I'm Arnab.
And you're listening to another episode of Kathakar, a podcast in which we discuss important turning points in history and their human aspects.
Throughout the history of civilization, there have been key moments that have defined its rapid growth. From increased output, trade, and technology came the idea of division of labor, or specialization, which allowed for members of society to take up different roles to support the community, creating increased output and greater innovation. However, a question has lingered throughout sociological research. How does specialization emerge from communities engaged in mechanical solidarity? This problem is not simply constrained to history, as the origins of collectively coordinating specialization lends itself to better understanding industrial development in our modern world.
To delve further into the history of division of labor and specialization, we are joined today by Dr. Emily Erickson, professor of sociology at Yale University and academic director of the Fox International Fellowship. With Dr. Erickson, we discuss her paper titled Network, Property, and the Division of Labor, and explore her use of computational and simulation-based methods in considering the effect of different network structures on the propensity for economic producers to develop a complementary division of labor. With that being said, let's get started. All right. Hello, Dr. Erickson. Thank you for joining us today. Before we jump into the paper and all the specifics for the model that you published, we would appreciate it if you could give us some background and contextualization on both Smith and Durkheim's perspective on the specialization and division of labor.
Sure. So Adam Smith is the sort of first great theorist of the division of labor, where he was writing in the context of a mercantilist world where nations were presumed to be in competition with other nations. And what he argued, and the sort of, I think, very significant lasting contribution, was that different nations could produce different goods and everyone would benefit because of the sort of extra expertise or skill, or just maybe resources that one nation had to produce a certain good, meant that it was produced at a lower cost, that it could be sold to other nations for lower costs, and that if all of these lower costs are combined and everyone specializes, you know, in more specific goods, then they exchange with each other, the entire world benefits from the reduction of costs. And that he's arguing at the level of nations, but of course it's also very true at the level of individuals that, you know, if we focus on one task that we have a sort of expertise in, then combine that with other people that focusing on other aspects of tax, and we bring it all together, you know, just like a car is made, you know, someone makes the tires, someone makes the engine, someone makes the frame. And it's better if we have factories that focus on those specific goods, then we put it all together at a much lower cost to bring that thing to market. So the division of labor, he sort of introduced the idea that this is this amazing thing that everyone and nations should take advantage of. But he didn't really think about the difficulties involved in actually organizing a division of labor. For him, he's sort of like, well, it's a specialization. It's so beneficial. If the market expands, then the division of labor is going to expand. But what Durkheim, Emil Durkheim, the great sociologist, sort of thought more specifically about was, what are the conditions under which individuals and maybe even nations are going to successfully engage in a division of labor, or successfully divide up certain tasks? Because if you think about it, so from Smith, it's like, oh, it's so beneficial, it just happens if you let it happen. But it's actually a very complex coordination problem. And that kind of cooperation is potentially difficult to achieve. So, you know, if you're thinking about like Thomas Hobbes, he's like, no one automatically cooperates. Instead, the human race is short, brutish, and nasty, and they automatically have conflict. So you could also believe, you know, depending on your view of human nature, that people don't automatically cooperate. And you could also believe that since the division of labor is actually a pretty difficult coordination task, it might be even harder to achieve. And so Emil Durkheim made this argument. He didn't about specialization and the division of labor emerging when there's a sort of sufficient population density, a lot of interactions. And then also, and he argued, and people sort of ignore this, and it's a little bit politically problematic, I would actually argue that there's a sort of underlying ethno-nationalism that's necessary for people to have the kind of positive bonds that would then support a division of labor. I don't agree with that. And it's a kind of a robust nationalism in Durkheim that I think people skip over a little bit, but is problematic.
So you detailed there how specialization of labor occurs within like certain communities. So like, what are like the two couple of conditions that really enable specialization of labor to really occur, while what are some conditions that make specialization of labor kind of not happen in communities?
Oh, well, so that's a really interesting question. Are we getting into the model already? Because this is the, or, you know, the paper that I wrote, are we talking about previous hypotheses?
Just let's do previous hypotheses first, and then we can move into the actual model.
Okay, so previous hypotheses about what actually allows for the division of labor to occur. Yeah. Well, so I would say the first thing that I need to highlight is that in previous work, say Adam Smith, Emile Durkheim, or even sort of the organization's literature of the 20th century, which is recent to me, they did not actually quite pinpoint the difference. And there's a really important analytical difference between a division of labor and between specialization. And so a lot of the literature kind of talks about those two things, but almost all the literature talks about those things as if they're the same. The difference is that specialization is sort of like market specialization, you know, like different countries produce goods, and people, you know, purchase those goods, but maybe there's still competition. So, you know, you need factories to produce paper, you need factories to produce butter, you need factories to produce milk, right? Those things. But, and they're producing different goods, and we need all the different goods really in order to live our day-to-day lives, but they don't have to coordinate the actual process of producing the goods in order to bring them to market, if this makes it. So, but in the division of labor, and this is a really sort of a crucial difference, when you're actually dividing the labor that goes into a task, you need all of the components to be coordinated so that you can't make a, you can't make a car. If one person in the kind of commodity supply chain doesn't produce a good, like they don't produce the tire, the car is no good. You just, like, it doesn't matter that you have the rest of the car. It's not a car without the tires. So there's these differences. There's labor, which is like a lot of added value, but it takes more coordination. So that, you know, past literature, they tend to talk about the division of labor, but what I would say is what they really mean is sort of like more like specialization. And when they, and the main factors tend to be over time, just density, increasing economic development, certainly a market economy. It becomes really important. Fungible good, like money, you know, you have to have, money is important because it easier to exchange for a range of goods, so that specialization is, you don't have to exchange one good just for another good in barter, which is actually as complex a coordination process as the division of labor. So once you have money, it becomes easier. And then what would be the other main precondition? Private property, sorry. Important for specialization, because you have to be able to accumulate sort of surplus resources and defend those surplus resources in order to accept them.
Okay, and then that's why, like, Smith always, not always, but that's why he talks about having a centralized government was really important to establish communication between, like, people for being able to trade.
Yeah. I mean, well, for Smith, I think, so in for having an established, so yes, the government would defend sort of property rights. I mean, what's interesting was for Smith, read in different ways, but what he really wanted the government to do was to engage in sort of anti-monopoly regulation. But in the government in his time, so now, you know, mostly often because of Smith, all think of monopoly as a negative thing for consumers, a lot of profits for themselves that don't have to do with the value of the goods. They just do it because they're the only people supplying. And we all generally accept that as a bad thing. At Smith's time, monopoly was a regular form of business. And what the government actually did was to award monopolies to different people. And that was, we're going to encourage like growth by awarding this monopoly to an individual. Or it didn't even have to do with economics. It was just, you know, I'm returning a personal political favor by giving this person a monopoly that's going to allow them to become an extremely rich person at the expense of everyone else. And that's fine. That's just how we do things. So interestingly, Smith was a little bit anti-governmental in the sense that he didn't like that the government of its time was spent all of its time a lot of its time in business spheres enforcing monopolies. And he wanted the government to stop enforcing monopolies. And he sort of thought that was the main governmental action. But it was good if the government's engaging in peaceful trade and enforcing peaceful conduct of trade. And also, you know, protecting property rights, as long as they're not claims to greater resources than should be awarded to the individual.
So I was actually wondering if we could go a little bit more in depth into private property as a precursor to division of labor. So I was just wondering, when one, you know, say there's one firm that owns the means to production of all different parts in the production of one good, how does that, you know, how does private property tie into this? So I'm just wondering if the state owns all the good, the means in producing one good, then wouldn't that still have some form of division of labor? That's just in my line of questioning.
Okay. So if the state owns it owned all of the means of production. So I think the issue is that the individuals that are producing goods in order for exchange, if the state takes all of the goods away from the individual, then they could still, the state could potentially then organize some kind of an exchange that would match up people and sort of perform the function that the market otherwise performs by finding individuals that are going to be, that are exchanging the right goods so that they both like benefit from the process. I think the issue is that's the state. So that's a lot of work for the state. And I don't think, even though we have a lot more technology and things, but, you know, even the, as powerful as, for example, the United States government is, there's limits to what it can accomplish. I mean, you know, like they haven't been that successful in getting everyone to the vaccine that's going to save their life, right? So to believe that the state's going to successfully match all the individuals that are producing different goods and then get them to engage in the process, I think it's like a little outside of what at least our current states are sort of capable of to do. They might try, but and then you have the problems of corruption in the state and taking the goods away from the people, and they can't engage in the exchange. then the whole thing's kind of, then they're not going to specialize in goods. They're just going to produce the goods that they need for themselves in order to subsist, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. Yeah, that gives us a better understanding of that situation. And I think now we could switch gears and, you know, move towards the paper and understanding, you know, the use of network analysis and understanding the evolution of a division of labor. So we were just wondering, you know, in the beginning, how did you think of applying network analysis to this sort of problem? What was the motivation behind network analysis, and why not some other form of model or other mathematical technique?
Well, so I mean, in some sense is a little bit of a default for me. I was trained by Harrison White, who's a great network theorist, Peter Behrman and Duncan Walt, great network theorist. So I find that to be an extremely useful way of thinking about the world. I do think it's not just that I was trained that way. I think that, you know, networks of relationships are this incredibly important substratum of social existence that we can't directly observe. And so we don't always understand its impact on our life. And so, you know, if there's something out there that people don't see with their eyes, and that nevertheless has these, you know, exerts this huge forces, that's like what science is for, right? I mean, if you think about it, like, if you think about germs and viruses, it's sort of similar. Like, and once we had microscopes and people could observe the fact that there was these bacteria that were causing illnesses, it changed the existence, you know, in this like incredibly impactful way. And so with networks, I think there's similar potential to you. These are these things that we can't directly observe, but we understand that they have a huge impact on people's lives, on the way societies function. And so I think it's really important to study them. And that this was one of the ways that I could study networks and its impact on people, and in this case, even more specifically on economic development and sort of commercial sophistication. But that also has to do with resource distribution and sort of, you know, like the potential for all of us to have the kinds of goods that we need in order to flourish in our lives. So that's, it was a little bit natural, but it's also true that part of the impetus came from there's a game called the graph coloring game. And this is from this old sort of like graph theoretical problem, which was, if you have a map, how can you color, like how many colors do you need in order to make sure that each country on the map is a different, or each region, whatever it is a different color from its bordering regions or nations or countries. You know, so you see the value of that, right? Like you can recognize that they're different regions, and probably reduce costs or something like that, right? But it's an interesting problem, and it turned into this that, you know, people, scientists, because they like to think abstractly and you know, sort of like hopefully get to the problems, turned it into a graph theoretical problem where if you have a node and it's connected to other nodes, you know, like what are the minimum number of colors that you need in order to have it be different, a different color from its other nodes. And once it was at that kind of abstract level, it became, I think, easier for people to think about it in social contexts. And so it had been thought of things like, if you have a ringtone, you know, it's better to have a different ringtone from other people that you're around so that you know it's your phone, right? So, and there's certain things, or you could think even, you know, like Korean people, like they like to like a different film than everyone else so that they sort of stand out, or, you know, a different band, something like that, right? So there's definitely moments where it applies to social life. And I read about that. I heard about it. My co-author Hiro was working on an application with the coloring graph problem, with my colleague Nicholas Christakis, And I heard about it from them. And I just immediately, I'm an economic sociologist, and I think a lot about like cooperation and economic development. And when I had it described to me, I was like, oh, the division of labor, that's like, we can just, it was so crystal clear. I was like, oh my God. And I, you know, it's just amazing, almost to me, that no one had used it to think about the division of labor previously. But it was just instant with me. And I convinced Hiro to start on this paper with me, and it's turned out great. Actually, we just won a paper award, which is nice.
Congratulations on the award. And, you know, we definitely loved reading the paper. And, you know, if that means anything for the...
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely. It's really nice.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the next thing we could go to is, you know, talking about the four-color theorem and the four-color problem. Just thinking about it, how does the four-color problem come into play when considering division of labor and how it evolves? You know, that's just the question that we generally had. You know, how did you realize that, oh, I can use this problem here in this problem I can use this theorem or this approach for this problem of division of labor?
Well, I mean, it's a tough question in some ways. So as I just described it, you know, I mean, and I think science and creativity are sometimes like this, is that, you know, it wasn't a rational thought process for me of, this is an interesting thing. Like, how can I match it up to something else? It was really kind of a moment of inspiration where it was just instantaneous that I saw this model and I thought, the division of labor. It was just like porting things. I like to see how they might apply in different or different areas than they have been previously. I think it's usually just, you know, it's like a, it feels great. Like, it's like a moment. Exciting ideas that you get very enthusiastic about. So that was, I would say, just like a flash of inspiration. But working it out and thinking, of course, through the different problems in transporting an idea from one realm to another is the more, I wouldn't say tedious, it's still very interesting. You learn definitely along the way, but it's much more methodical. And that definitely took more time because it's not an exact one-to-one correspondence, right? So that's like one of the wonderful things that working through it revealed was that it's not just that the division of labor is not just being different from everyone else that you're connected to, which is more like specialization. The division of labor is being different from everyone else being different from at least the number of people that are needed to produce the other components of whatever good you're trying to ultimately create as a group. So you can be connected to someone else that's producing the same thing, but what you really need is to be connected to the other people that are producing those other items you need to complete the good. And so it's different. And what's kind of fascinating actually is that it turns out that the network topology that supports a division of labor is actually like that, where you have to be connected to the other people producing the other goods, is very different from the network topology that supports the kind of specialization or graph coloring problem where you just need to be different from everyone else that you're connected to. So that to me, and it's almost opposite the network topologies that promote coordination in those different kinds of games or setups. To me, that's sort of one of those indications of how important network topology and patterns are, even though we don't directly observe it.
So when trying to use the network and graph coloring model, were there any like specific assumptions that you had to make to like simplify and use the problem? And Were those any pitfalls you had to try to avoid? Because I imagine that trying to analyze something so complex, it's a lot easier to simplify it down with a few assumptions.
Oh, definitely. No, definitely. Well, I mean, our assumptions are actually pretty strong, right? we had to make a lot of really, really significant assumptions in order to model things. So what would be the strongest? I mean, probably we can only do a sort of a small number of goods. And this is a really, so that obviously isn't exactly the world that we observe, right? Like people just like the number of goods that are produced in the world is almost an infinite amount in some way. But there's only certain goods that are substitutable for each other, right? So it gets really, this then becomes a very complex problem to work out is, you know, what goods are functionally substitutable for each other and what goods aren't. And so if you think of like, we all need food and water to live, right? But like what are the different goods that count in those categories that you can imagine people specializing in? So we had to just simplify all that down into, okay, we're just going to assume that there's in a certain graph setting, there's four goods, let's say, that people have, that people can choose to produce. So there's going to be different configurations through which they can reach out and exchange to each other to get all of these different goods. But even in task management, you know, if you think of, so it makes sense to think of this as the production of goods, or you can think of it as people have different components of a task that they're trying to accomplish. So there's been studies on in laboratory settings that, you know, task management in order to sort of like analyze a compound, there's complex machinery in people. The best way to do is to break it down into different tasks where like some person turns on the machine and some person inserts the thing. You know, I'm simplifying again. It's hard not to simplify. But that can be broken into sort of like an infinite number of different kinds of tasks, right? In the end, the specific nature of it. But we have to just assume that like functionally, like the people are just going to break it down as like four tasks, you know, and that even though it might be a little bit different, same with the products, even though the tasks might be a little different, like are somewhat overlapping in different ways that people could possibly imagine those tasks, that like what it really means, like usually you're just going to break it down as like four, and that we can kind of like model that process at an abstract level. The other really important assumption that we had to make, and it would be nice to try to loosen it and figure out a way to do it, but it's a little difficult, and I'll explain why, is they're all static networks of exchange that we look at. So there's no movement in terms of that one person has a relationship with another person. They don't, in our model, stop, you know, say like, oh, you're not giving me what I want, I'm going to go find a different person. And the reason that we do that is because we, in order to sort of understand the parameters of the model, we have to calculate this thing called the chromatic polynomial, which is a sort of a match between the number of goods produced, or the number of goods, or the number of tasks that we're thinking of being produced in this context, and the number of solutions there are, right? And the solutions being different choices that different nodes or people make about whether or not they're specializing. And maybe just for the audience, it's probably easier to imagine this in terms of like the map problem. So if you have the map, the chromatic number is, which is in the chromatic polynomial, is the lowest number of colors that you can choose to color the map and still get everyone to be different on the borders. The number of solutions is the number of like different colorings that you can get, all the different ways you could color and all the different colors that you design and still have a successfully colored map where all of the countries are different from each other. So in order to calculate this chromatic polynomial, which we have to do for to understand like what's causing the outcomes that we're observing, it's we don't have a dynamic version of that chromatic polynomial. We can calculate it on a static version of a network, but then one of the things that's so fascinating about it, to be honest, is it's super sensitive to small changes. So you could change like two relationships and have them go a different way. And the chromatic polynomial can vary, like the variance is so large. It's just amazing. For a network of like 22, the variance in the number of solutions is like between 100 and like 20,000. It's like amazing because it's exponential properties of graphs. That's actually one of the first things that I was like, wow, I have to study this further. Like, it's so incredible. But the problem there, if you imagine, like, so if you move one relationship and then suddenly the number of solutions is completely different, and then you move it again and the number of solutions is completely different, it's very hard to understand how the number of solutions there are to the problem is like impacting the outcomes that you observe. So what we wanted to do was just think about the network topology, not so much the number of solutions. So we had to like sort of control for it and therefore keep the network static.
That's so interesting because, you know, that's what makes the system like so complex. You know, when you're a small change in one parameter causes a gigantic change in a different parameter. It's just so interesting how these complex systems work. And, you know, when analyzing them, we have to see the extent of change occurring. But that actually leads me to my next question, which is on data. So in the paper, we see that, you know, there's a lot of simulation. You build different networks and, you know, test to see the number of solutions that come up. But I wonder, you know, how the model works when dealing with real world data coming from, you know, different communities in the past, you know, whether or not the evolution of the network and the choices follows a real society's path towards division of labor.
Well, so it's sort of like to be explored, really. So what we're currently working on right now, so the paper now is just a computational model. We do have a couple, we have a kind of a toy model where we have an existing network that's the Taro Root Exchange in New Guinea. But we use that as sort of a base model from which to then simulate the exchange patterns on. So it's not actually looking at exchange and how it develops over time in a community. It's something that is very much on my to-do list. I'm a historical comparativist also, and I really like using empirical data. So this is something that I want to do, but currently what we're doing is trying to set up the experiment in a laboratory setting where individuals can interact in exchanging and coordinating the exchange of goods in a preset network topology, but where the individuals are really making choices within that. So that's the stage that we're working on now in terms of getting this, you know, very abstract model and seeing the extent to which it's going to give us more insight into the actual conduct of sort of day-to-day affairs. I do think personally that it would be amazing to think about how it could give us insight into the development of the division of labor and specialization over time in the early prehistory of sort of human society. That it's, you know, it's like difficult to get data on that in like to the extent, you know, so ideally you would want to have a lot of information on goods that are exported from, say, like different Mesopotamian cities or something like that are linked by a river network. We just don't really have that level of detail about a lot of the, I mean, to be honest, we don't even really have that level of detail for current cities, unfortunately. So it would be, I mean, maybe that's where I should start, something a little bit less ambitious and try to get more data on things that are occurring right now. It's probably, I guess in one way, that's the laboratory setting. But I do have one student who I had working on a project on modeling like the potential outcomes with the Roman road network, which I think is an interesting application. And so that's at an early stage, but something that I think could develop more fully over time. I also think looking at river networks in different areas and sort of comparing across regions with different types of access is something that could be developed further in order to kind of get a better sense. Like maybe that would be a new kind of explanatory device for observing different levels of development across regions or something like that.
So for the data that you did have, we saw that you had some information from Papua New Guinea. What was the source for that data? And then were there any specific trends that you noticed or found interesting after running your analyses?
Oh, of that specific, so, okay. Oh gosh. So that's from a really great book by an anthropologist. And that you're really like testing my knowledge. The paper, like we wrote the papers like 2 years ago now. Oh, I can find it for you. Should I find it? I can find it, but it would take us to inform analysis. Well, of course, I mean, as long as you're citing the work, then I think most authors, you know, they want, that's why we publish, is in order to assist other researchers in, you know, building a world of knowledge that's useful to more and more people. So when with a book, you just want to, you know, acknowledge the contributions that the people made. But so using the data, we thought it was a great thing to use this tarot exchange, because it's a moment where there's like incipient specialization in a sort of a tribal society that is not existing in what we would consider to be sort of, you know, like a kind of market economy with lots of specialization. It's certainly in a kind of a pre-industrial state. So I think a really interesting example also just to think about is, you know, it's a different kind of mode of social organization. Of course, in more modern and industrial societies, there's still gift exchange, right? So, which is the tarot exchange. So it's not like it's something that's disappeared from societies, you know, outside of New Guinea or, but I think that the process of sort of transformation and social transformation in these smaller, they're like, you know, smaller than, for example, the United States, right? Like it's a society is like somewhat contained, it's smaller, and you can observe changes more easily. And the changes are usually really illuminating and fascinating. So I'm just reading this book called, I think it's called The Evolution of Inequality. It's about the development, and it looks at sort of tribal society, pre-industrial societies, not just pre-industrial societies, but sort of pre-market societies and around the world, and how inequality and specialization and sort of and private property and hoarding of goods are develop over time, and what are the mechanisms they usually do develop in these societies. It's very rare that they don't, and like what are the mechanisms through which inequality is produced. And I think it's kind of similar to the tarot root exchange, and that's actually one of the examples in that book also. Is and why it's interesting is you can see things develop that we just observe on a regular basis in our society, but can't kind of like dig through all of the complexity in order to find out where they first began.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very interesting how, you know, you can take the real world case from like the small community, because like in all sorts of historical research problems, especially when you're trying to understand what happened in the past. It's really hard to get data. So that's why we were just wondering, like, you know, where you get these sources of, like, where you get this kind of data from, you know, just for our own interest, our own, like, little projects, or just to understand how that works. So I guess the next question that I have is actually on, you know, understanding inequality. So I saw that, and you even touched upon this a little bit, but I saw that in the paper, there was a way in which you could understand that inequality would develop based on the results you got from the model. I was just wondering if you could get into that a little bit more.
So inequality is not possible without surplus goods, right? In a subset, you know, so you because if everyone, I mean, you're assuming everyone's like subsisting. And so if everyone can produce the goods in order to subsist, the more extra goods you produce, the more, and this is just a formal property of a system, the more extra goods you produce, the more potential there is for inequality. Because, you know, there's a range of like, can those goods be distributed across all people, or are they going to be unequally distributed? And, you know, if they're, the equal distribution is just like one of all, if you think of it like as a probability spectrum, like equal distribution is like that's one potential outcome. And then there's like a bunch of other potential outcomes that are more unequal distributions. And the most unequal distribution involves also just like one possible outcome, but then there's a range, and in between there is like at least some degree of inequality. Yeah. So, I mean, just like, this is, I think, one of those things that people don't necessarily always understand, but just like by random chance, if you have resources in a system, there's surplus resources, like you're much more likely to get some degree of inequality than no degree of inequality. Does that make sense? So in the system, the specialization, the coordination of labor, that's probably going to, the more goods that you produce, you're going to get a surplus if you divide labor, because that's the point, right? Is that to increase more goods. I mean, so there's benefit for all. But when you increase the production of goods, then there's also the potential for more inequality. So that would be, I think, where the two kind of intersect in the paper.
So you did talk about, so that's, that makes sense now. So the thing that the next question I have then is, you talk about how there's a spectrum of inequality, right? You know, there's can be complete inequality and then complete equality, and you know how inequality just, you know, results from surplus goods. I'm just wondering, you know, based on your simulations, on the spectrum of equality and inequality, what is the frequency of, you know, different levels of equality and inequality that you obtain? You know, are there greater frequencies of higher inequality or greater frequency, or is this just solely dependent on the surplus amount of goods?
Oh, no, it wouldn't be solely dependent on the surplus of goods. It would be depending on how the network topology would almost certainly also determine the distribution of goods ultimately across different individuals. That's a super interesting extension, but we didn't actually specifically analyze that in the paper. So I can't speak to it. We're just thinking right now about sort of optimizing the coordination process. I would say one thing that's kind of interesting though, and this is outside of the scope of the paper, but it's definitely an implication, is that what we model in the paper is decentralized coordination between individuals. So another way of solving that problem, and what we ultimately find is that a decentralized coordination in the division of labor, when you, it is complex coordination, like difficult coordination process, is easier when you have like simple repetitive structures, network structures, like repeated patterns. And that kind of indicates that if people occupy pretty well-defined social roles in the world, then probably like these complex coordination processes are going to be a little bit easier. And that also you know, like we kind of chafe against a lot of really rigidly defined social roles in our sort of modern society. And I think that we do so because often they're accompanied by models of inequality, right? So one person is in one role and they're sort of like given resources or status and deference in a way that other people in other roles aren't. And like you could say, like in a lot of early societies, men and women, like men are given much more deference than women, but they're really well-defined social roles. And so they probably helped with complex coordination processes, but at least like maybe one of the more unfortunate side effects was that then there's a stratification system that evolves with these role systems. So here, and for me, I was like, it sort of suggested that, oh, wow, like stratification and hierarchy, probably part of the reason they're so prevalent is they help people solve these coordination problems. So I think it would be sort of a challenge for us as social scientists to think about, well, how do we get the benefits of stratification in terms of coordination without the sort of evils of denying people rights and kind of, you know, impoverishing individuals and things like that.
So going further into social science, is there ever a point where specialization and division of labor does more harm than it helps with like efficiency in producing goods? Or is it, because I'm assuming it's sort of like a logistical model, right? Where there's eventually a decay off for the benefits.
Well, so not the way that we model it. I mean, I guess that would also be another one of those assumptions. But we always, so for us, since the benefit to the individuals that are in, that are engaging in the division of labor is by definition in our model is higher than if they're just engaging in subsistence where they're producing all the goods for themselves. So if it's by definition is higher, then the amount of goods produced is always higher the more people are actually engaging in the division of labor. So the total production for society is highest when everyone's dividing labor. And that, but it's a model assumption. So, I mean, it's a good thought experiment. Could we think of an instance in which the benefit is lower? I mean, so I could think of it empirically, but I, but it wouldn't be, so it would be hard to think of an abstract model. I mean, empirically, I could say, oh, well, people say this about academics often, right? They say, okay, there's a really very significant division of labor in academics. Like I study sociology, physics is completely different, and like biology is completely different. And when we get into a room, I can like my colleagues in those departments very well, but when they describe their research, I'm like, I really don't know that word you're using, and I don't know the research, you know, context, and it's just very different, and I would not be able to contribute to their research, right? And they wouldn't, they're not really able to contribute to necessarily some of the problems in the social sciences. But people, like, so we think of that as producing returns, but sometimes people would say, well, it's so specialized that no one's thinking about how all these problems are brought together, right? Or no one's thinking of the bigger picture anymore. Everyone's just like off in their little corners, solving the separate research problems. And what we really need is someone to like bring this together. So there would be an instance where specialization could be too extreme and then less beneficial. It's harder for me. So I can think of an example where specialization would be too much, but it's harder for me to think about how that would relate to a mode of production, like the kind of mode of production that I sort of have in the back of my head when I'm thinking about this division of labor problem in an economic context. But I do think it's possible and something that should be considered.
Yeah, I was only asking just because from the economics class that we took, I was just thinking that like the marginal product of the next worker hired always like diminishes eventually until it becomes like either zero or negative, which obviously that's not a good thing. But yeah, I was just thinking about it in like economic terms. So I guess the next question I would have would be more on the specific conclusions that you found from the research that you did. So like, can you talk a little bit more about what, I guess what the most interesting results were to you that you found?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I thought the most, like, to me, it's just fascinating that that you take a simple restricted network model, right? So usually networks, networks of people are just like super complex, fuzzy, crazy things because people tend to make random connections and, you know, like our lives are in like much less routine than we kind of perceive them. You run into different people that relate. So this, and just small changes in interaction patterns produce a lot of randomness. And that's why, like, for example, the small world model is so amazing because it captures a lot of this randomness and shows how like this has a significant impact on connectivity and different things. But it like, it turns out, I mean, that's what we kind of associate that kind of complexity with modernity and specialization. And the thing that I thought was just so stunning was that it turns out that all that complexity and adding this randomness actually is really detrimental for the complex coordination process of the division of labor. And what you need there is, you know, is a really kind of like rigorous, like strict imposition of order and pattern. And, or at least that's the best way to manage this complex coordination process. And is sort of like Borges, the Forest of Winding Paths, or, you know, if like you, if there's too many paths, you get lost, and instead you need a narrow trail, or as we call it in the papers, so it's like a guardrail that can keep people kind of on track to solve this otherwise somewhat difficult problem. And that is, I think that's sort of fascinating. As someone that, like, I used to, before I went to graduate school, I used to go to have lunch at the same place every day. It was a rice and beans place, one of these Cuban rice and beans places. Oh, so good. Loved it. And the thing that I found was that even though I was eating the same thing every day, it was like a little bit different every day. You know, there's something about it. So to me, it was, you know, there's sort of a beauty in this somewhat counterintuitive idea that you can sort of find freedom within within structures, you know, within some kind of like more rigid guidelines. Sometimes that can actually help solve problems and that you wouldn't otherwise be able to solve. I find that like very, very interesting.
So following conclusions, I think we could go to extensions now. So, you know, I think we already talked about the idea of dynamic networks and, you know, considering inequality. But, you know, besides these, are there any other extensions that you're considering for the paper?
I mean, the two main things are the lab setting, and then the historical potential. I think it would be really fascinating to think about commodity chains. I mean, I think that, you know, we have so many supply chain problems right now, and the network of connections is changing. And I think that it's very possible that this, you know, I mean, we do actually exchange and have supply chains with only certain parts of the world. You know, I mean, these things, there is a network structure to them that's relatively static. In fact, you know, there's some shifts, but there's a static nature too. I mean, for example, we're not doing a lot of exchange with Russia at this point, right? So those kinds of things can be captured by a model. And I think it's at least possible that this model, this kind of like multipartite model that's thinking about exchange, could possibly help explain or like maybe predict better sorts of ways of managing those complex networks. Like, it's possible that could have a very practical application in that area. I mean, even if you think about sort of vaccine development, right? Like, I mean, that's a real division of labor problem there. We do want, all the nations want to have vaccines that protect against all of the most threatening diseases, but they don't have the capacity to produce all of them. So a lot of nations certainly don't have the capacity to produce all of them. So then I think that's an extremely important kind of division of labor problem there too, that this could have some kind of application for.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, we talk about all these, you know, the problems in today's world. And, you know, I just wonder how, you know, there's network analysis and then there's, you know, network design. So how does network analysis inform network design? So that's why I'm just thinking, you know, what sorts of constructs would you use in network design when, you know, trying to influence a certain way in which labor should be divided or specialization should occur? I know this might be going into the math a little bit, but maybe a little bit, if you could talk about just, you know, just at a basic level, how this could work.
So the question is, how could network design help? I'm not sure I got the question completely. Could you rephrase? I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically what I mean is what kind of constructs would you use when designing a network and understanding the potential of the network, or when you're constructing a network such that it carries out the needs of society? Kind of like when you're constructing a game so that it carries out the needs of the two people playing the game.
Right. I mean, it's a very hard question. I think it's going to take a lot more research. The problem, of course, is the world is so complex and that people are playing many different games at once, right? Or, you know, there's many different problems that are being solved. And that's another kind of layer of complexity. Right now, it's, you know, we're just trying to figure out this one particular set of problems and issues that, I mean, what I would say is network theory and research has, I was like, for the past 10 years or so, is mostly focused on diffusion. Right? So you have simple contagions, complex contagions. It's mostly thinking about just like, you know, getting resources or information from one place to another, or, you know, or disease epidemiology, right? Like where it's a negative thing. But it's just mostly modeling one thing traveling through the network, and that this is an attempt to introduce a slightly more complex problem where you have different things like circulating through the network, and you're not just modeling something like going from one part of the network to another, but instead thinking about the exchange problem, and that it would be quite a step forward if you think about society, right? Like obviously people are also there at the same time exchanging goods and diffusing information. And then, so even just to get to the point where we're thinking, okay, well, what kind of network model is going to both diffuse information and support cooperation in an optimal fashion? Like I think we'd want to get there first before, you know, trying to think about designing a network model that is optimal for all of the different things. Like I think that's a little ways off, I guess. But I mean, the other problem, of course, is that like if you're talking about relationships between people, it's one thing if you're talking about relationships between organizations or nations even, but if you're talking about between people, I'm not sure that we can ever say, you know, okay, you have to be friends with this person, you know, not that person. So I do think it's good to understand, you know, and it's good to know, but it's unclear that we can actually alter or intervene in certainly in human relationships in a way that allows us to have control over these kinds of things.
All right. So thank you so much. I think the final question that we have is, with the results and data that you have collected over this paper and just in general, what do you think you can, like, where do you think you can apply all of this data in the future? Or is there anything that you plan on using this data for?
Well, I mean, we've already sort of talked about a little bit, those things. I think, you know, the laboratory experiment, I do think, I mean, I'm super excited about this data and this paper. And I think that the possibilities for further study are, you know, all very, very wide open. Like, I think that there's a lot that can be done. And so that the laboratory is just like the laboratory experiment is just the tip of the iceberg. And we're talking about just kind of replicating this idea about the division of labor itself. I think that there's also a lot there that is revealing about temporality in exchange processes that can be further explored. I mean, one of the things that's hard about the coordination of the division of labor is like all the people have to exchange at pretty much like close to the same time in order. You can't kind of produce one thing, then a year later produce the other thing if you want this good to be useful to people in the short term. So there's that's like another very interesting thing, because when you get groups together, just think about now, you guys mentioned that this is the first time you've been in a room all together, even though you've been doing the work all together, right? So that's like a temporality problem in a sense, like it's worked out, but just getting everyone together in a group in order to engage in the exchange is, it becomes harder the more people are involved in the process. And that's kind of another aspect of this that is pretty interesting. And in really the difference, I would say even more generally between group processes, like the division of labor and market exchange, which is mostly just two people exchanging at one point. And market exchange where it's just two people is just a lot easier to manage because of this time problem. Like you don't need everyone to kind of coordinate and get together at the same time, which, yeah, it seems like it's just exponentially more difficult. So I think that's like a very interesting formal component of group behavior that could be explored further with this model. There's other things. I mean, as long as you're thinking that different people are different in the networks, there's all kinds of, like, you could think about heterogeneity. You could think about like segregation processes, you could think about desegregation, you could think about what encourages cooperation between different, are there different network topologies that encourage people to cooperate with others that are different from themselves? I think there's tons of applications.
There certainly is, yeah. And, you know, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great episode. We got to learn about, you know, division of labor and its evolution, along with, you know, using network analysis in your paper, networks, property, and division of labor. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Erickson.
It was my great pleasure. So nice to talk to you all.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Kathakar. Make sure to check out some of our other episodes on our website at kathakar.media. You can also listen to them on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and many more podcast services. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to join us next time.